opening of the subject, which goes back to late 60s, early 70s, when the technique was developed to address the questions of ultraviolet divergences in Einstein theory, and the seminal work of Stoff and Veltman led to the conclusion that Einstein gravity coupled to matter is not only power constant, not normalizable, it's actually not producing finiteness matrix before getting on graviton once matter is added. So later on it was confirmed that indeed the counter terms which one could expect to appear at high loop on the basis of just dimensional coupling, they do appear, and the two loop computation by Gorov and Sagnotti led to the conclusion that Einstein gravity should not be finite. And the sort of point, one could sort of take various different attitudes to this, and one possible idea is just to try not to ask questions which one shouldn't really be asking at low energies. So one could try still quantize gravity, but keep in mind that if we're interested in low energy phenomena, we can take a point of view which is fruitful, say, in pion dynamics, and consider low energy Lagrangian, where we include all possible interactions, we randomize all possible divergences, but then we are led, we are left with infinite number of undetermined constants. And still we could, certain low energy phenomena can be described in this framework, and you may think that you actually need few high derivative operators to describe certain phenomena. So you could try just proceed sort of phenomenologically. And indeed, some questions can be addressed in these in this rather naive approach. And just few examples are some recent papers by Donahue, and where one actually includes gravitons in loops, and or one could consider being inflationary cosmology where Higgs is assumed to be the amplitron, and there one computes one studies randomization group flow, randomization group equations, and in principle there is a mix. If one includes non-minimal coupling, you will have mixing of gravitons and scalars, so you need to include gravitons in loops as well. But still, the issue is. Oh, but still left with the main question: what is the field which is valid to all energies, and can we have a predictable theory which is actually predictive, and where all these infinity of unknown constants can actually be predicted and in principle measured. So the main issue is how, what is quantum theory of gravity? How we define this theory? Is it just starting with Einstein theory, or taking some lattice version of it, or some other triangulation, and then trying to define continuum limits and all that. So we need to decide about symmetries, about basic variables, and very broadly one could start with an idea that gravity would be fundamental. Gravity described by metrics should be fundamental, and we should be in four dimensions, and we should ignore matter in the first approximation, and then try to define some regularized version of theory, and then try to define continuum limits. So when that would be one approach, or try to add high derivative terms, and then try to define theory at low energies, which would be unitary without any contradiction. So another point of view is actually that one shouldn't try to construct quantum theory of gravity, but rather one should try to construct theory of everything. By everything, at least standard model couples to gravity. So if you want to describe early universe, which at low end is described by standard model, we need to address questions of how it's coupled to gravity. And if supersymmetry exists in nature, maybe combining all fields together in a certain way, which has extra symmetry, will actually lead to finite theory of quantum gravity. There will be no divergence at all. So this supergravity is originally was constructed with this idea in mind. And indeed, there is interesting recent progress in this direction. So finally, one could take an even more radical point of view that Einstein gravity is just a low energy, large distance phenomenon. And there should be more fundamental theory, like string theory, which describes, which actually is defined on all scales. And what we see at low energy is just like pion Lagrangian, while quarks and leptons, quarks and gluons are the analog of quarks and gluons, are just needs to be discovered. So option one, which is just trying to start with Einstein, with theory of metrics, is obviously not an easy option, and that was the topic. That's the topic of this conference. There are various approaches, but it's obviously a non-perturbative question in that way or another. And one starts with quantum theory, which should be defined by certain plus integral, and then plus normalization group. I think one standard quantum theories which we know how to define, they're based on asymptotic freedom or fixed points, they are finite. And in fact, most natural realizations of fixed points of finiteness are actually in the context of supersymmetric gauge theory. Now, there are also issues about general coordinate invariance, and more important issue is how natural is this theory. Is it really no fine tuning? Is it predictable? And can one actually calculate what are the observables and all that? So one can take a much narrower point of view and ask, suppose we consider near flat space and we want to define scattering of gravity. And we want not to make any assumptions apart from maybe low energy scattering. So we don't want to produce black holes and all that. So what is the expression for these four graviton scattering amplitudes? Can the theory produce it, which will be consistent, ultraviolet finite? And that's the question which I want to keep in mind when discussing various options and of what quantum gravity may be. So supergravity definitely can try to answer that question. And in fact, by combining gravity with matter, one bypasses the question about non-finiteness of quantum gravity coupled to matter. It's postponed up to three loops. So at one loop, matter is related by supersymmetry to gravity. So gravity is one loop finite. So supergravity is one loop finite as well. So at two loops, supersymmetry is really important, and it rules out this wild cube tensor term. Again, there are no two loop divergences in supergravity in this matrix. And then one obviously raises the question whether some supergravity maximus of a systematic local maximum systematic gravity theory can be all loop finite. And in the past, starting from the early 80s, there were discussions of could that happen. And obviously, the answer seems to be no, because there are natural counterterms which one could write down. And in fact, the first one should appear with three loops. It should be fourth power of wild tensor. So a three loops naively there exists a counter term. It depends on what kind of control over supersymmetry one has, what kind of superspace counting rules one uses, etc. And more recently there were refined discussions of what supersymmetry may be telling us about on set of divergences. And very recently, and that will be discussed in the talk by John Carrasco, and basically last year, there is a remarkable progress in this subject, and it was discovered that angular weight supergravity is actually finite at three loops and four loops. despite the fact that naively one could think there is a three loop counter term and there should be divergence. So what we know at least a theory which has, say, four graviton scattering amplitude, which is finite up to five loops. Actually, any graviton amplitude is finite up to five loops, which is a kind of non-trivial, extension of this old work of Stoffen Veltner, which found one loop finite graviton is native. So this progress, which will again, it's not really my subject, it will be discussed in later talk, is it started sort of from studying of gluon scattering amplitude and using lessons which came from Angular 4 to the Anneaux theory, and combining these lessons with spring motivated sort of idea that gravity amplitudes actually can be reconstructed from gauge theory amplitudes. They're kind of square of gauge theory amplitudes, and trying to carry over what we know, results of Angular 4 supergravity to Angular 8 supergravity. And that's the authors of this recent work. And quite interestingly, the cancellations which happen at three and four loops, and again that will be discussed later, they're not really due only to supersymmetry. They seem to be more, have to do with the structure of gravity itself. So they're more universal than, there are certain cancellations that are more universal than just the ones which are due to supersymmetry. So that's actually very interesting, which may be suggesting that we may expect some further surprises. Though, again, there is no good, really, really good reason to expect from what we know at the moment why NQH supergravity should be finite. At least there's no obvious, there are certain arguments, suggestions that maybe there are some hidden symmetries, etc., or not so hidden symmetries, but like E7. But none of these arguments actually rigorous or convincing. So N=8 supergravity has also rather other remarkable features. In particular, this matrix always is suggested to have some rather remarkable features. And again, there is a different unrelated work on this matrix which suggests that. But even if N=8 supergravity is ultraviolet finite, in perturbation theory, one would have still all sorts of questions about non-perturbative formulation of it, whether what that actually means, whether we can come to the big theory. But these questions are way beyond the horizon at the moment. But they are discussed in literature. Well, some people are worried about massless black holes, which appear at certain parts of modern state of Angular gravity because there are massless scalars there. And then one could also try to worry about the question of whether Angular 8 supergravity is actually limit of string theory. In that way, it may be better defined non-perturbatively, but again, there are debates whether this is true or not. Now, postponing, sort of going back to just gravity theory and giving up with Einstein theory or supersymmetric extension, we may just take a very naive point of view and ask, like in any other theory which is defined in certain dimension, you may ask, if I imagine having lattice theory and take continuum with it, what kind of operators would be most natural? Which will be relevant, which will be marginal, which will be irrelevant? So in this case, in gravity theory, in four dimensions, The answer would be that the marginal operators are squares of well tens. They have dimensionless couplings, A and B. And the relevant operator is Einstein's term, which is like mass term. And finally, there is a constant, which is the cosmological constant. So that would be the natural theory to start with and to randomize it and study randomization group flow. And indeed, in some way, this is analogous to, say, starting with Young-Mills theory in six dimensions, where usually a minimum squared term will be like mass term, and you will have higher resistance. So postponing the question about unitarity, just on formal grounds, thinking of this Euclidean statistical mechanics theory, you may think, what if we compute on loop optimization group flow in this theory? And in fact, this question was asked a long time ago. In fact, it was motivated partly by Weinberg's work, Weinberg's talk in 76, 79. In fact, if you look at this first paper, Jules Vitton's paper, they explicitly discuss this asymptotic safety scenario in this context. And so this computation is obviously not so easy. Well, even with the lessons which we draw from Soft and Weltman, this is high derivative theory and lots of interactions. So even on loop computations, technically, they're quite challenging. And in the original paper by Julian and Tony, they attempt to do that just by Feynman diagrams, and they made the missed contributions, and they were confused about whether it can be free theory or not. Anyway, so this was improved in our paper later, where we sort of generalized Soft-Weltman algorithm to four derivative theories and made the computation more straightforward. And the conclusion was that in all essential couplings which appear in the theory, and this is essential means those which should be relevant to matrix, and I'm not going to discuss it in detail, but essentially A and A is asymptotically free coupling, 1 over A goes to 0 at ultraviolet, and A over B has fixed points, so B is also asymptotically free. This is something about sine waves, and the ratio, the product of lambda and m squared, which is dimensionless, ratio of them is also asymptotic freedom. Sort of asymptotic freedom theory is essentially induced by asymptotic freedom of A. Interestingly, if you couple this theory to meta, say gauge theory, you cover by four theory, you get, thinking of this theory, it's really like a Young-Mills, extra sort of kind of Young-Mills theory. It's power contrary and normalizable if you look at the system. So it mixes naturally, like with randomization of various other terms, you can add standard method terms in Lagrangian. So you get a sort of mixed randomization group equations for all fields, and what we found is, in fact, one could actually induce asymptotic freedom in some other couplings, which are usually not asymptotically free, like Yukawa and Masters. And the possibilities are very fixed points, and so that's an interesting system. All that would be really nice if not for obvious and physical nature of these high derivative terms, and that's the question of unitarity, which can be rephrased as what are the asymptotic states. And if you want graviton to be asymptotic state, only asymptotic state, we really need some non-perturbative formulation. We need to understand what happens at infrared limit, where since this is asymptotic free theory, as in Young-Mills theory, we need to understand some coupling region. So there were a few attempts to deal with these questions through the years, and to my mind, there is no conclusive evidence that this theory, or rather, we don't have enough tools to prove or disprove that this theory is unitary or non-unitary. Naively, it looks non-unitary. So, before I make some comments, since I mentioned this unitarity issue, it is actually a rather peculiar issue. One may try to argue that maybe we should somehow redefine what we mean by unitarity. Maybe we should try to start with Euclidean theory. In principle, such high derivative theory may be well defined in Euclid. Partition function may be well defined, and then you can try to define what would be kind of a native continuation in Minkowski. And one example of that is the work by Fonting and Herzog, and they were trying to argue that on the, an example of scalar theory of high derivatives, that maybe there is a way of defining theory which is actually has no negative norm states, have no negative probabilities, but it kind of has unitarity emerging at low energy. So a few comments about this high derivative theory are, well, there was a discussion about quartic divergences, and that's an interesting story, but we kind of know examples in the past. If you take off, say, sigma model in two dimensions, you get quadratic divergences, but they actually cancel if you prepare the measure properly. So quartic divergences are sensitive to the definition of the theory. What is the measure of the theory? Because of any delta of zero term will give you quartic divergences. As for quadratic divergences, the theory here is really analogous to a massive theory, say, five-fold theory of Remarque. So M squared R term is really like mass term in a Remarque theory. So quadratic divergence would be treated in a similar way as mass minimization, as is done in any other theory of masses. So there is a well-studied question of what is the minimization group equation for masses and all that. And the dimensionalization is as good as any other, and especially if we go beyond one loop, that's more or less unique way of defining theory. It's gauge theory, it has local vision energy. So now, what about asymptotic freedom beyond one loop? That's a very, very interesting question here, because it's by no means obvious why asymptotic freedom should be the feature. For example, what happens with the realization of this coupling A? Why this is less obvious than, say, the Young-Mills theory? In Young-Mills theory, we know the two coefficients to the beta function, and in one coupling theory, that these two coefficients are unambiguous, and that gives strong evidence that Young-Mills theory could be better be asymptotically free. There is no fixed point, for example, but in this theory, it's less obvious because once we go to two loops, these couplings A and B will appear in beta function of both A and B. At one loop, it's only B which is sensitive to A, but A is not, beta function of A is not sensitive to B. At two loops, that's a change. And in principle, one could imagine that actually there is a two loop fixed point for A and both B. Also, if we get, if we add also Young-Mills term here, it will be like on the same footing with C squared and R squared. So beta function will mix, Young-Mills beta function will receive contributions from A and B, and these may receive contributions from Young-Mills. At high enough loop, at one loop that doesn't happen. So there are lots of possibilities of fixed points indeed, in the interesting randomization group flow structure, but that depends on what are actually two loop beta functions. So two loop randomization in this theory seems to be a very interesting problem, and it actually may be the key to understanding what happens in this theory. But it's obviously a very hard problem, and but still, it should be practical with modern technology. We definitely know much more than 30 years ago. By that, I mean we have even, well, we have computer problems, and we have more experience with dealing with time-defining graphs. So that remains a very interesting question for the future. So if one starts with this high derivative theory, one could try to sort of simplify its structure in a way by trying to demand extra symmetry. And the one obvious natural symmetry, which could, one may think, may be very natural to have at high energies, that would be local scale invariant. So since Einstein's term, as we just discussed, is more like a mass term, why don't we start with just Weyl theory, which is kind of unique if we demand local Weyl invariance. And then we will generate Einstein term by coupling it to matter, by coupling the state of scalars, and the scalars have excitation value that would produce Einstein term at low energy. So that could be, in a very naive scenario, how to induce low energy gravity. So advantage of this approach may be, it may be even better defined as a Euclidean path integral, because C squared is manifestly positive in Euclidean all that. But here we hit an important issue, is that this theory, if we demand wild symmetry, there is a chance that this theory is well defined only if it's actually ultraviolet finite. So we have conformal anomaly, and that means conformal factor of the metric will get dynamic, just like it happens in two dimensions. Same happens in four dimensions. So unless, if we demand we don't include conformal factor in the path integral, and that is equivalent to demanding quantum wild symmetry, we must cancel conformal anomaly. Just like analogous statement in two dimensions is demanding critical dimensions of string theory. So conformal supergravity actually is an answer to that question, how to cancel conformal anomaly. If one, there are supersymmetric generalizations of this theory, which have diffeomorphism, wild symmetry, plus their analog, which correspond essentially to gauging conformal groups in four dimensions, introducing, making it local, just like wireless symmetry is a local scaling scale transformation, and diffeomorphism are local translations. So conformal supergravities, they are labeled by number of supersymmetries, so they exist up to n equal 4. And beyond n equal 2, and then at n equal 2, they are ultraviolet finite, they are power transient analyzable, and they are also ultraviolet finite beyond one loop. And then that can, one can argue basically the same way as one argues that n equals 2 should be Young Mills because of the one loop beta function. So what remains is just to cancel one loop beta function if we go to n equals, say, 3, 4 conformal supergravity. And indeed, there is a unique theory, well, unique modular some group structure, unique theory which is wild invariant and finite. Well, that's essentially equivalent to finite. Right? So beta function is zero. In a sense, it's analog of n equal 4 Young-Mills theory, which sort of generalizes wild tangent instead of generalizing Young-Mills. It's just n equal 4 conformal supergravity coupled to 4 n equal 4 Young-Mills multiple. So why n equal 4 theory, why Young-Mills theory is very natural? It's actually like, it's a natural meta theory here, which has the same amount of symmetry, but the global symmetry of this theory is gauged in conformal supergravity. So just like n equal 2 Young-Mills can be coupled to factor multiples, so n equal 1 Young-Mills can be coupled to n equal 1 meta multiples. Meta multiples for conformal supergravity are this Young-Mills, n equal 4 Young-Mills. So if you just take 4 multiples of Young-Mills, and that could be, they can be organized in SP2 times U1 gauge group. Whether it's gauge or not doesn't really matter. Coupled to conformal supergravity, that defines ultraviolet finite field. So Young-Mills theory is finite by itself, and coupled to conformal supergravity, it makes beta function well tensor squared tending zero at one loop. And then it's true also to all loops. But still, we have the same issue of unitarity and high derivative, plus we need to induce Einstein term and a lot of various other fields which are, once we make it supersymmetric, there are other fields also having high derivative. So I mentioned this because this theory is kind of extremely nice as far as the symmetries are concerned. It's really maximum extended conformal symmetry gauge, which is conformal in four dimensions. You can have superconformal, n equal 4 superconformal symmetry is maximal conformal, extensive conformal symmetry. And if you gauge it, that's the theory which you get, n equal 4 conformal supergravity. So now I want to switch to string theory. Just in my discussion of various options, we reach this most esoteric option of gravity not even be part of our path integral, rather being some emergent thing. so we should see metric only at lower enough energies, but that may be the key to resolving this ultraviolet problem. So string theory has certain features which make it rather unique, and in a sense it automatically includes gravity. If we just look at this matrix, a flat space, we have massless into excitations. We don't have high massless spins. That's the only massless in two particles, which is there. And effective field theory approach here is really very natural. We just integrating highest string modes, you generate high derivative terms in the effective Lagrangian. So for these gravitons, if you start with string theory, compute the three level as matrix for gravitons, and then reconstruct which effective Lagrangian reproduces it, that will be some series of terms like this with fixed coefficients. So it's a unique effective action which corresponds to string theory. Now, quantum string corrections, so that would mean the loops of all these string modes, including gravitons, they are ultraviolet finite, and that has to do essentially with built-in cutoff, which is inverse string tension, or effective non-locality, which one can see in the string theory framework, where one has an implicit sort of damping factor. So string interactions are very soft at low, at high energies, and that is the key to that ultraviolet finite. So one can explicitly compute, say, one loop for graviton amplitude, two loop for graviton amplitude. They are finite and well-defined expressions. And one could extract various quantum corrections to this effect of Lagrangian. And the pattern of ultraviolet finiteness is to see what happens, how alpha prime acts as a cutoff. One can compare, say, Einstein gravity in 10 dimensions. Yeah.
Bring down the R terms. So. But I guess it's still supersymmetric at low energies.
Sorry?
I guess it's still supersymmetric at low energies.
Yes. Well, yes.
So you're only writing, so it's not that.
No, you definitely, in superstring theory, this is supergravity plus.
That was just my question. So it's a complete supersymmetry.
I'm not discussing breaking supersymmetry comparing to real world. That's
sure.
So the, if we say start with Einstein gravity in 10 dimensions and ask the same question, what are ultraviolet divergences?
At one loop. So we obviously have 10th power of cutoff, 8th power of cutoff, R square, that would be R. And then somewhere we'll have, so that would be 1st power of R. Then will be quadratic divergence, which is R4, and then will be Lagrangian divergence, which is R5 plus various other invariants, which have the same dimension. Now, if you compare this to what you actually get as effective Lagrangian from say, 4 graviton spectrum in string theory, what you will get R4 term with one of alpha prime coefficients is finite. So if you take alpha prime to 0, that will give you this quadratic divergence. Similarly, analog of these terms will be some finite term, non-local finite term containing alpha prime. Again, if you take alpha prime to 0, that will generate it and provide a divergence. So that's the just illustration of that alpha prime plays the role of this built-in cutoff. But there is a price for finiteness. We're dealing with a rather complicated theory, functional theory, instead of usual quantum field theory. We have infinite number of modes, and they're organized in certain mathematically quite complicated ways. And in particular, just looking at string scattering amplitudes, one may be frightened by view of complicated loop integrals. The model measure is not understood beyond whatever 3-4 loops very well. But in fact, string perturbation theory is organized much better or simpler than quantum field perturbation theory. Instead of Feynman graphs, or the better way of saying this, the string theory tells us how to organize quantum field perturbation theory so that it looks much more schematic. And the reason for that is that string interactions kind of are based on single splitting joining strings, and that it translates into a certain description of how one writes loop directions. It's very economical organization of Feynman diagrams, and in fact, starting from string theory, one can extract the wisdom how one should organize quantity theory perturbation theory using first order, first quantized formalism, essentially. And that was discussed in quite some number of works, sort of how to use string theory logic to reorganize Feynman graphs. And also one could use string theory methods to extract S-matrix, even say for gluons or in open or closed string theory by taking off a prime to zero limit. And again, there are some literature on that. So from practical point of view, one shouldn't really be that much frightened by the view of string theory. Now, the standard sort of mantra or the standard words one can hear from people working on string theory, that string theory is very fertile framework for a consistent theory of quantum gravity, but we're still rather a preliminary stage of understanding. And the obvious open questions are, what are the symmetries? Can we actually have good control over non-determinate aspects of this theory, et cetera, et cetera. But there is, instead of trying to fight on all fronts, one could deal with various of these various options, which one various questions I can ask string theory, sort of one by one. And one important piece of recent progress, which actually gives an idea of how, maybe gives an idea of how string theory should properly be viewed in which context, is this gauge string duality. So there is a particular string theory in ADS5S5 state, which is used in the Forsyth-Young-Mills theory. And that duality, strong relation, it actually uncovers hidden simplicity in string theory. So it's in some ways emerges in certain limits of gauge theory. And that string theory is string theory in curved space, where there is a certain regime where you can actually see scattering of gravitons in flat space. So you could, quantum gravity phenomena is hidden there, in a way. So just to give an example of what kind of unexpected connections, connections which one can get here when one thinks of this gauge string duality. If one asks the question, why string theory is all finite? The answer of that question, the same question gets translated in gauge theory framework as the statement that 1 over n expansion of Fitian-Mills gauge theory is finite order by order in 1 over n. There's no pathology there. So why? Because 1 over n is translated in the string coupling corrections. And so in a sense, this duality tells us how to use string theory or gauge theory to define each other, both of them, in a sort of non-perturbative way. By recent, I mean 5 years or 3 years, 4 years, because the real progress happened when, since I have time, I'll quickly review that. Real progress happened this is very, very basic, very, very ideal example, which is more like example of harmonic oscillator Ising model, namely n equal 4 Fitian-Mills due to particular maximally symmetric string theory. But this example has a remarkable feature of being integrable in large n limits. And that integrability allows one to make highly non-trivial statements about gauge theory, becoming very easy statements about string theory and vice versa. So I have time to say a few words about that. So it has nothing to do with quantum gravity, but it does illustrate that string theory is not some artificial construction which is unrelated to any, maybe it's still unrelated to quantum gravity, but I think I would resist even that. But it's definitely related to gauge theory. And it's actually very natural and useful concept in the sense it's because of this relationship. So, supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. There is a bigger context of QCD where there should be also some relation to string theory. Yes, it's clear there should be, but which string theory is unclear. So there is some. The debatable issue is whether this kind of phenomenological string theory, really string theory where you can treat it as a string theory and make some progress. So this gauge string duality, in a sense, is the relation between one particular string theory in curve space, which generalizes supergravity in 10 dimensions. So it does contain quantum gravity in a way. And in certain regime, one can try to isolate this regime where you'll have scattering gravitons in nearly flat space. And you may have the counterpart of that scattering describing gauge theory terms. And gravity theory is really emerging from gauge theory in certain way. And locality, in a sense, is emerging. So string variables are non-local, but gauge theory is local, but you do end up with string theory once you consider strong coupling region of planar gauge theory. So before I comment on this idea's CFT in more detail, just to give a few examples of the power of this duality.
supersymmetric Young-Mills theory is inherently non-local? Because you say you end up with non-locality in strong
coupling. In Young-Mills theory, you have Wilson loops, which are non-local objects. There is certain variables which are non-local.
But the theory is local.
Yes, the theory defined by original path integral is local.
You can always define non-local observables in any theory.
Yes, but the point is that string variables, which are useful for description of, say, in very narrow sense, anomalous dimensions of local operators in Young-Mills, they are non-local.
They are naturally non-local. So it's the same statement as why don't we start with Young-Mills theory but reformulate it in terms of Wilson loop, like write some McCain-McDowell equation and deal with that equation as fundamental.
It's not a non-trivial one because you cannot construct a theory which is both unitary and local.
Yes, with gauge invariance.
So it's a particular problem. There's some amount of locality, obviously, but it's not local in the usual sense.
So anyway, so if we before I get into that, just about
what would be the conclusion of my talk? So. There is a possibility any quantum supergravity is finite all orders. I don't myself see reasons for that, and nobody, I think, knows the reasons. If that happens to be true, that would be quite remarkable, and we definitely will learn something very important from that. Defining quantum gravity non-perturbatively, and that's the topic of this conference, that is very interesting direction, and we heard different talks about that. I heard we heard talk by another law, and it was kind of different approach compared to talk based on a randomization group approach. But the real issue here is whether any of these approaches can be turned into predictive and practical formulas for quantum gravity, and also what about matter and all that. So that's it's an interesting program for the future. Now, part of that, or separate from that, is this issue of can this R squared theory, hydrated theory, can be actually defined as a starting point and in some sense maybe made into unitary theory. By that I mean there will be no contradiction at low energies and there will be some predictivity about high energies, and that probably depends on whether indeed this theory is controlled by fixed points, which remains to be seen. So string theory seems to be best bet for UV completion of Einstein gravity, but there are obviously many questions here as well. And but what I want to emphasize in the next few minutes is that apart from, aside from simply being candidates for quantum gravity, it is definitely very useful for gauge theory, and we learned quite a lot of in practical terms as far as technique of dealing with perturbation theory and gauge theory, non-perturbative gauge theory, using string theory tools. So in a sense, string theory describes the safest of all theories, which is finite and equal at least. And then we can deal with other gauge theories, sort of deforming that that story, hopefully. So let me just make a few comments on this gauge string duality. It's completely unrelated to what I was talking about before, and unrelated to the topic of this conference, but just to give you a flavor of what one gains in this, on the way of discussing the gauge string duality. So the main sort of general aims of this enterprise is try to understand gauge theories at any coupling, and here we deal with, say, finite gauge theory, like any paucity and Mills, and we would like to have control over its perturbative and non-perturbative observables. It's observables in both perturbative and away from strong coupling. Also, there is another side to that story, and let's try to understand string theories in non-trivial curve background, in particular, backgrounds with Ramon fields, which are relevant for phenological application of string theory. So this idea of CFT duality relates sort of two different questions, namely the question about string theory and the question about gauge theory, and try to suggest to deal with them at the same time. Sort of assuming these dualities, which one needs to prove rigorously, but there is very, very strong evidence at the moment that this is the exact statement. Assuming that duality, one can actually learn from, one can make statements about both sides and then see whether they mesh into some consistent picture. So integrability, that's the key word which led to important recent progress. And that has to do with very special features of NCO4, Young-Earth-Young-Mills theory, and that particular string theory which is involved.
No, it's a feature of planar limit, but then you can perturb it in one more end. But indeed, whether integrability is useful beyond planar limit, that's a wide open question. What we're trying to, the attitude here should be that we're trying to understand one very special example. And that example, I'm going to talk about is integral infinity soft limit. And that's where integrability appears. And in a sense, it's infinite. Hidden infinite dimensional symmetry of both gauge, certain observables in gauge theory and string theory. So the parameters here are Toft coupling on gauge side, and it's related to string tension on the string side. And so what this integrability controls, it controls the dimensions of gauge invariant single trace
operators on gauge side. Or that's equivalent to spectrum of energies of gauge theory states defined on three spheres. So we're dealing with conformal theory, so it can be defined on a plane or on R times S3. And on the other hand, these are integrability may be also controlling some features of correlators of these operators, but that is a more complicated question. So at the moment, the question is about the spectrum of anomalous dimensions. So in conformal theory, four-dimensional conformal theory. And the string theory basically gives an answer for the spectrum of anomalous dimensions as functions of top coupling, so always in top coupling, even beyond perturbation. So this is this remarkable recent progress which led to understanding how to describe the spectrum of anomalous dimensions. And the key example, one example of how this happens is anomalous dimension of the operator build out of, say, few fields and many covariant derivatives. So in Young-Mills, in NCO4 theory, you have scalars, and you can consider, say, an operator built out of covariant derivatives and scalars. So anomalous dimension is just the power of the distance in the two-point function of such operators, and it's controlled by a function of lambda, top coupling, multiplying log s. So anomalous dimension is proportional to logarithm at large spin, at large s, proportional to logarithm of s times a function of lambda. And this function of lambda is very important observable of gauge theory. In ankle four theory, it's just a series of terms. And in planar limit, this series has finite ranges of convergence. So in just computing Feynman graphs, you generate various coefficients that recouple. And then if you imagine, you can sum up the series, and you'll get some exact function of lambda, and then you can re-expand this large lambda. What do you get? And the answer is you get expansion with start with square root of lambda, and then the terms of 1 over square root of lambda. That looks like alpha prime extension string theory, because string tension is square root of lambda or 1 over alpha prime. Remarkably, that's the same expression which you get by doing just perturbation theory in string, on string side, starting with string theory in curved space in ABS 5S5, identifying the string state which corresponds to this operator, and just doing alpha prime expansion, one gets these numbers. Moreover, these two expansions are they originate from one integral equation which is coming out of integrability approach, which is controlled by beta ansatz. So in a sense, what we understand at the moment is equation for this function f of lambda, which does have the right, which kind of glues together two perturbative expansions, one seen from gauge theory, one seen from string theory. So beyond, well, not only these operators with large s, with large quantum numbers are described by string theory, but in the last year, there was progress and Pedro Vieira, who is at Trinity Institute, was one of those involved in understanding how to go from anomalous dimension of very long operators to anomalous dimension of short operators. And that's the essentially suggestion which to what, when we try to define the integrable sigma model on a plane in two dimensions, if we understand it on a plane, we can then try to understand it on a cylinder. And that involves going from asymptotic beta ansatz to thermodynamic beta ansatz. And playing the same game here, one gets a description of not only very long operators, but operators with small quantum numbers. And there is ongoing progress, ongoing work now to connect, again, what we know in perturbation theory, on Young-Mills theory, and what we know from string theory, and glue this together into single statements about anomalous dimensions. So key example here is an operator, say, built of two fields, pi bar and pi, two scalars, which is called Kanishi operator in the supersymmetric gauge theory. And in perturbation theory, at small lambda, what one gets is, again, a series of terms, powers of top coupling. So some of these terms are actually computed just by from Feynman graphs, but this last term was computed using methods induced from sort of understanding that should be due to some string theory state. So remarkable, you can sort of use string theory methods to make predictions about weak coupling results, which are actually hard to get by just Feynman diagram computation. Again, at strong coupling, this thermodynamic beta ansatz approach and perturbative string theory approach predicts how expansion of this anomalous dimension look like at strong lambda. And it goes like, again, power of string tension and then upper prime extension. So in the mathematics, which is based on integrability, in a sense, relates again these two extensions. And the hope is that we are close to more sort of practical understanding how this actually happens for all operators. So to sum up, leaving aside open questions. So to sum up, what I was trying to say is that though string theory may look esoteric and strange, certain string theory in curved space, which is nothing very specific, not particular, in some limits it will look like strings in flat space if you have the radius of this ADS space very large, which means top coupling is very large. Very strong coupling gauge theory, but very weak coupling string theory. It will look like strings in flat space. So that string theory actually is closely related to gauge theory, and moreover, it's closely related in the sense that if you look at some five loop term, in usual perturbative expansion in gauge theory, that actually knows about, in a way, it knows about how string theory is organized in this curve space. So that, in a way, is as best as we can go so far in relating quantum theory of quantum gauge theory and quantum, or actually here it's more classical string theory, quantum in two-dimensional thick model sense, which still contains gravity. So that, in a sense, Einstein would be very much surprised to know that a certain theory containing gravity has anything to do with a theory like Maxwell's theory. Just trying to unify everything together. Thank you.
At least partially the cosmological. Yeah, in a sense, it's fine tuning. You can fine tune cosmological constant to zero. Of course, you are not going to solve cosmological constant problem, even if you assume supersymmetry, which will kill this quantum divergence manifest, because it just counts the number of three. There is a physical cosmological constant problem, which is the one why we're not inducing at each phase transition all that, sort of like you see vacuum engineer. But there is a technical question about this power divergence. So technical question, you can again deal with it in two ways: assume an extra symmetry or fine tune it. You can always subtract it, fine tune it, or put a measure which will, in two dimensional sigma, putting the right measure just kills this parallel divergence.
No, but the most careful definition of the measure over geometries known so far, the one by Motola, Mazur et al. If one takes that as a starting point, and one this definition amounts to a definition which keeps power-like terms.
I agree with that. You can use that definition.
No, but it's a thoughtful definition. So,
if I use the measure accusation, which I have no, I don't see any objections to it. The question of measure becomes matters.
No, but I mean, if the long term goal is to make contact to some kind of non-perturbative formulation, but you better use a regularization, which at least gives a chance to do that.
Yeah, I agree, but my question would be that suppose you use, well, there are various approaches, like the approach which Long was talking about. There is a Humber, Williams, I think, also worked on some lattice version. There are all of these approaches. I'm not sure if you start with that approach, what kind of measure you will get.
No, but in any kind of discrete version of a measure, Ragey calculus and so on, if you tune the spacing, the lattice spacing to zero, obviously you will get power-like terms. I mean, power-like divergences in the lattice spacing. So if one wants to make contact to a lattice formulation, to any kind of non-perturbative formulation, one should better use a regulator which keeps track of power-like divergences.
That is all very nice, but I don't see any connection between what you were discussing and that particular measure you were referring to. You're never using any measure.
No. There is, but
okay.
Just to go on this point, I mean, it's clear that from point of view of perturbations here, you can do dimensional analyzation and get rid of However, this will not define the theory, we define the property expansion. If you take the nonlinear sigma model, and because the problem with the measure, the delta of zero comes from the problem of quantization. It means that if you suppress the measure, you have classical theory remain the same, but you have changed, you are not using the proper quantization of the quantum theory. But if you do a nonlinear sigma model, you just keep the measure. And we know that the measure is a geometrical origin, and you do that when you integrate from the group. So if you cube that, you still have the same perturbation, that's fine, but you're constructing another node.
So I completely agree. There is a question, but what I was trying to say that for the issues like perturbation, this is a relevant question.
No.
It is.
No, it doesn't matter as long as you only look at the coefficients of the log divergences. In fact, if you do standard perturbation theory of a nonlinear sigma model on the lattice, you also must keep these measure terms.
On the comment of Jean, I would like to comment that the persistent reason for which we don't have non-perturbative field theory, non-integer dimension, that I think is an issue which is important. And ultimately, I tend to think that it needs some rethinking of our view, of our approach to field theory. For instance, we should perhaps less emphasize functional integrals and more emphasize Feynman graphs, because they can be interpolated in dimension, and then the problem of knowing whether there is a non-perturbative theory behind could start from trying to resolve them.
Any theory explain the limit is defined by perturbation. Plane perturbation theory is convergent.
Yes.
And
that's a starting point. Not here. We would like to limit ourselves.
In a way, again, one could turn it upside down and say, okay, plane of perturbation theory defines, you can define perturbation theory, then you get classical string theory, then you can quantize it, and that then defines one way. Yeah, that's silly.
But in principle, you should be right. I mean, you should be able to use dimensional regularization, right?
As far as perturbation theory is concerned, I have no reason to believe you can gain some physical mileage out of including power divergence. Non-determinate, I completely agree. You need to define theory first and then deal with it. And,
you see, but on the technical level, what will happen in terms of understanding that perturbation is not the right sum of them. And by using dimensionalization, you define only the series. But when a series is not the right sum of them, there are exponential corrections. And this you don't know about.
That's true.
Okay. Therefore, you're not defining one theory, you define a class of theories. But as long as you make that perturbation, of course, you don't see the difference.
So could you go back to one slide? Just go forward.
Forward or not?
Well, you had just, we have a statement that about your Super Yang Mills theory correspondence. So it's where you were admitted here, yeah. Now you say assumption of exactness.
Yes.
And I just want to know, why did you choose to phrase it this way?
Yes. Okay, so if you look at string theory,
yeah.
So you can look at Yang-Mills theory and look at perturbation theory and look at what you actually get from Feynman graphs for the anomalous dimension operator, anomalous dimension matrix which can call anomalous dimension. It happens to be equivalent to a Hamiltonian of certain integrable spin shape, one-dimensional group. So using that, you can diagonalize anomalous dimension matrix for complicated operators and get anomalous dimension. So integrability is used. It's just observation that is related to certain integral tension. Moreover, you may ask, what could that continue beyond one, two loops where you can actually do final graphs? And the answer seems to be, appears to be yes. Why? Because looking at string theory, which is thrown up in description there, you also see that integrability is just integrability of classical string theory, which means a classical signal model, which has hidden conserved charges and just like sine wave theory, more or less. So then you may say, OK, let's assume this integrability actually applies to all orders in lambda in plane integration. Then, taking lambda large, you'll hit string theory limit, classical string theory limit. You'll relate integrability in gauge theory to integrability in string theory. Or vice versa, string theory expanding alpha prime to high enough order, that will give you control over one or two lambda expansion in gauge theory. So it's some, and I'd say assumption, which it's more like at the same level of assumption like when you take certain integrable two-dimensional theory and you make assumption that it's actually quantum integral. So it's assumption of quantum integrability which you need to prove or check. Actually, proving is strong word. You need to make sure it's consistent. And all we know so far is consistent with that.
Any other questions? Okay, let's turn the speaker.